This is oral history interview number 26 on Monday, May 24th, 1976.
To all of you for taking the time to come and talk to us about the history of the medical school, and particularly to Dr. Arneson, who did so much work about getting it all organized and ready to go. What I thought I would do, if you didn't have any objection, was to speak into the tape recorder a little biographical sketch of each of you, which I have here, and then turn it over to Dr. Arneson as chairman for this group. Is that all right with you?
That's fine.
And if you would talk about the changes in the educational scene that you have seen over the years here in the medical school, the physical quarters, and also the practice of, since you're all obstetricians and gynecologists, the practice of obstetrics and gynecology in the last half century, I think that would be very, very helpful to future historians. So with that introduction, let me start alphabetically with Dr. Arneson, who was born in Fort Worth, Texas in 1905 and got his MD degree here at Washington University in 1928. And then he interned here and was a fellow and a resident in gynecology at the Memorial Hospital in New York for several years, and came back to be various things in Barnes Hospital, associate attending gynecologist, and so on. Until now, he is a professor of clinical obstetrics and gynecology, and associate professor of clinical R radiology. During World War II, he was a lieutenant colonel. The number of offices he has held got so large that I just put down a few of them, including the presidency of CAOG and the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists and the AMA, ARC, and he is so distinguished that I'm almost afraid to talk to him, but he's very kind when I do. Dr. Hobbs, John E. Hobbs, was born in Waynesville, Missouri in 1901 and got his degree in Washington University in 1927. It was an intern in obstetrics and gynecology for 1 year. I'm not quite sure what that meant at Barnes. And then he went in a resident for 1 year and then an intern in pathology. So he had both pathology and obstetrics, and you were telling me just before you were in surgery too. You were an intern in general surgery here at Barnes, and you were in St. Louis Maternity Hospital. Were associate surgeon in surgery and pathology and associate in obstetrics and gynecology. And now you are clinical professor emeritus of obstetrics and gynecology. And like Dr. Arneson, you've been on many of the associations. Finally, Dr. Melvin A. Robley was born right here in St. Louis in 1901 and got his degree in 1900. That's quite right. I'm sorry. And got his degree from Washington University in 1925. He did his internship and residency at Barnes for several years, and then was assistant in obstetrics and gynecology, both Barnes and St. Louis Maternity here and at St. Luke's Hospital, and was in the outpatient department of the university clinics in obstetrics and gynecology, and a professor of clinical obstetrics and gynecology, and many associations, including the Fellow of the American College of Surgeons. Again, let me thank you gentlemen all for coming here and being willing to do this for us, and let me now turn it over to Dr. Arneson.
Well, thank you, Dr. Boardman. You've been very generous. We appreciate the opportunity to meet here with you and to talk about the early history of the school and the hospitals. From the dates of birth that you've recorded there, you can see that you've got a group of individuals who will enjoy reminiscing. Dr. Robley was the first one on the premises here. He began his medical education in 1921. Marvin, when you came in at that time, tell us, if you will, a little something about the classrooms and departments and the medical school offices and your impressions when you first came here. But I'd like to preface this by asking a question. Now, at that time, Dr. Graham was here.
Yes, he was, Dr. Graham.
But I suspect Dr. Dock was still here as professor of medicine, was he not?
Well, Dr. Dock was just leaving. As a matter of fact, he left the first year we were freshmen. We didn't get acquainted with Dr. Dock. That was one of the things I think that through our 4 years in the medical school, we didn't have any strong department in medicine until Dr. Barr and Dr. Alexander came, which didn't mean that we didn't have a lot of younger men who were expert clinicians, and they gave us a background in clinical diagnosis that we enjoyed very much.
Who were some of these younger men? May I interrupt?
You sure, certainly may.
Well, Dr. Olmsted, he had been in the 21 unit in the medical department, and then later, during the time we were in medical school, insulin was discovered, and Washington University had a grant at that time, and Dr. Olmsted was in full charge of all the diabetic work in Washington University. Dr. Drew Luton was head of the cardiology department, and very promising graduate by the name of Barker. Dr. Paul Barker was one of his assistants. Dr. Paul Barker is my wife's oldest brother.
Uh-huh.
And not at the time I was in the medical school, that came later. But Paul left here to be associate head of the department at Ann Arbor, Michigan, due to his work in cardiology under Dr. Drew Luton. We could go on down the line. One person, briefly, Dr. Arneson, that stands out in my memory in all of our class, was Dr. Ellman. Dr. Ellman had a class in physical diagnosis at 7:30 in the morning. And it was a little difficult for those of us...
Excuse me, wasn't it Elmer?
Elmer is right. And there were very many amusing instances occurred in Dr. Elmer's... that's correct, you said Elmer, didn't I? Yeah, I did. Physical diagnosis class that we can reserve to later.
Oh, let's hear it right now.
Mm-hmm. Cancello, let me mention Cancello, that really I think was sort of borrowed from St. Louis U, gave us many very practical lectures. Some of the younger men, in addition to Paul, lectured. We had no definite outline until Barr and Alexander came in our junior year, and then we had a very strong medical department.
Marvin, would you tell us about the setup at that time for obstetrics and gynecology?
I'd be glad to, Dr. Arneson, because there wasn't a department, you know, of obstetrics and gynecology. Gynecology was simply a branch of surgery. And I understand from the juniors and seniors at the time we were freshmen that Murphy had a very strong department, and Murphy was head of the Unit 21 in surgery. Apparently, from gossip hearsay and our own observations, Murphy just wasn't around after Graham came. I don't mean that in a disparaging way for either man, because Graham is one of my, I think, made Washington University what Washington University is today.
Dr. Erlanger used to say that Dr. Murphy really wasn't interested in studying.
I don't think he was interested in a full-time position, and of course this was the beginning of full-time department heads. I really don't ever recall seeing Murphy in action. John, did you?
No.
The whole development of a department of obstetrics and gynecology in Washington University and other schools too, from history. We were in the transition period. By the time you had come on, Dr. Arneson, it was a department, was it not?
Yep.
Dr. Otto Swartz was back from his sabbatical year in Europe to be the professor of the new department. I was a resident obstetrician at Barnes Hospital from July 1 to August 15th, which was a short residency at Barnes. And then the St. Louis Maternity Hospital was open. And still, the departments wasn't OB/GYN. John Hobbs was my intern. And although he might have been on surgery at that particular time when we first moved in, were you, John?
No, no.
You were
on OB.
You were an OB. Crossan, H.S. Crossan, had the professorship of gynecology at Washington University, theoretically under Graham, and Graham wanted nothing to do with gynecology in his department. He was the chess man. I'm completely a half-breed. I had all of my residency and so forth, and zigzagging back and forth between surgery and gynecology and obstetrics. Does that answer your question?
Yes, it does, Melvin. Now, you mentioned Dr. Otto Schwartz had been away for his sabbatical. Are you referring to the period of 1 year he went abroad and Dr. Tausig took over the department?
That's right. And with Dr. Tausig, I would like to add that Dr. Dickman, Bill Dickman, really did the active work.
But Melvin, it wasn't until about 1928 that Otto went abroad and Tausig took over the department.
That's right.
Yeah. I'm sorry, because I thought you mentioned it earlier.
I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. I didn't mean to imply the earlier date.
Mm-hmm.
When I was going into my, I skipped a bit. When I was a house officer, right in 25, Mrs. Otto Schwartz, was in labor over a period of 2 weeks of induction by Daddy, so that the new baby could come before Otto went to Europe. Does that fit your dates, all right?
Yeah, now Daddy, of course, was Henry Schwartz. But let's turn over to Dr. Hobbs a minute. You know, John, it seems to me that the university has gone through different pushes, and there are push in this department, there are push in that department, and those pushes have resulted, as we look back over the past years, in the construction of different units, different hospitals, and different departments. The push for obstetrics and gynecology was really one of the first ones in the medical school. Now tell us about the classrooms, tell us about the hospital facilities, and tell us about Dr. Henry Schwartz and the yellow apron that he always wore. Where was the delivery room? Where were the patients housed?
Well, when I came on obstetrics in 1927, the Department of Obstetrics was on 03418 Barnes Hospital. That was the ward department, and the delivery suite was located on that area. The private OB patients were in the third floor of the pavilion, and we had to bring our patients, private patients, from the third floor pavilion down the old elevator to the basement. We brought them through the basement to the elevator on 3418 up to 3418 delivery suite. That was a long ways. I delivered some babies in the elevators and some babies in the basement at Barnes Hospital.
Without chloroform, John.
Yeah, right? Without chloroform. And, then in 1927, Maternity Hospital was dedicated, was started in 1926. And so at the dedication ceremonies, we had a professor from Copenhagen. He wore a stovepipe hat. I remember he collapsed his hat and put it under his chair. The dedication was held what would now between McMillan and maternity. McMillan hadn't been built yet. And I remember standing by Dr. Hugo Ehrenfest, and after the dedication ceremonies, I said to Dr. Ehrenfest, this is supposed to be the finest maternity hospital in the world, and I wonder how long it'll be before it'll be antiquated. I've seen it. I've seen it completely replaced. Now, at the site of Maternity Hospital, there were two residence buildings, two-story buildings, brick buildings. One was occupied by the superintendent of Barnes Hospital, the other by the assistant superintendent.
Were these the buildings that originally had been colored patients?
Yes, right. And they were demolished at the time. Maternity Hospital was the building program was started there. Now there are two, there was a parking lot. The parking lot is still present at the powerhouse. That was the only parking lot in the whole area. Parking was then done on the street. There was a little semicircle in front of Barnes Hospital and a little area back of Barnes Hospital, but most of the parking was done on the streets. And I remember looking down from anatomy many times on that parking lot. There'd be two or three cars on there. Where two of my colleagues had cars. One was an old Dodge, another an old Ford Roadster, and no other cars. Today, all students have big cars and so forth.
When did they take that? When did they put the colored patients in with the white patients?
That's fairly recently. I remember, of course, and all of us do, that colored people couldn't ride the elevators. Colored people couldn't enter any of the dining rooms, and they had segregated wards for all colored patients. And I would say that integration occurred in Barnes Hospital sometime up in the 30s, wouldn't you?
Well, John, I believe the colored wards were in the basement of Barnes,
right,
weren't they?
That's right.
When those buildings came down that you referred to. And we did have, as I remember it, at maternity, colored patients on the second floor of maternity.
Yes, that's right.
All right.
But they were segregated.
Still
segregated, yes, sir.
About the elevated part of it, the elevators, I don't recall that.
That's right. They couldn't ride. Colored patients couldn't ride elevators. They couldn't go into any of the dining facilities at all.
So that if they were on the second floor and they were about to deliver, they still had
they
to walk up.
That's right. They walked up.
I don't recall that.
Yeah, they did. They walked up. That's right.
That's amazing. I've never heard that.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Well, then, talking about the power plant, was coal-fired. And the power plant furnished electricity for all of the institutions. We had big piles of coal out there dumped from the railroads, and the smokestack belched coal smoke. It used to come into the, we used to get a lecture in anatomy up on the corner of the building across from the power plant. Coal smoke would come into those rooms and almost choke you. And you all remember, of course, talk about pollution today. In those days, we had such dense coal smoke, a lot of times we wore masks, our collars were dirty, our handkerchiefs were filthy, we had coal in our nose, and people that came to autopsy all had black lungs, I guess, anthracosis, right?
Yeah,
it also ruined our books. We have had to spend thousands of dollars to have them.
And in walking to school, I used to walk from over on North Kings Highway. Sometimes you couldn't see your hand in front of you. You could hear cars crash. Of course, people drove slowly, and you could see a little halo of light. That's all you could see. You couldn't even see. Now you have down here something about street lights. Of course, all the street lights here were gas. And we had lamp lighters that came
even
around.
In the 20s?
Yes. Came around in the mornings and lighted the lights.
Even
and he'd come
right.
around.
Right.
He'd come around and he'd turn off the lights in the morning. He'd come around in the evening and light the lights. Old Tony Randazzo, I'll never forget Tony. Stench in my nostrils when I think about him. And Dr. Arneson will say more about him later on. Now he has down here something about Barnes Hospital, the surgery department. Was of course located at that time on the second floor of the medical school building, and they had all the staffmen had their offices over there, including Dr. Graham, and they moved over to the barn side when Rand Johnson was built. Is that right? And so they had the pathology and all of the experimental laboratories located on the second floor of the medical building. Now, medicine, Dr. Barr came here in 27 when you
four.
Huh?
Came in 24.
Did he come in 24?
Yeah.
Anything else?
In our junior year.
All right. Well, anyway, Dr. Barr was head of medicine when I came here, and he gave us our first orientation lecture in the old auditorium, which is now the Carl Vernon Moore Auditorium. And I can remember very distinctly he talked about thyroid disease. In pathology, we had Dr. Leo Leib, was the head of the department, and he was a very distinguished man, and he spoke very poor English and very difficult for us to understand his lectures at times. But another thing I remember very well, we had a associate professor named McJunkin, Dr. McJunkin. He was a lame man.
Step and a half.
Yeah, step and a half. They called him step and a half. He was a very lame man. He had an impediment in speech. And he gave us an orientation lecture in pathology, what to expect, and so forth. And then he ended up. He said I hope you'll be a good class. We had a good class last year, much better than the year before. Only 15 failed a course last year. You've never seen so many pale, scared kids in your life at that time.
Later, John, I want to top that.
Now, we have down here railroad noises. Well, the railroad tracks, of course, still same place. And when we had our lectures in pathology, the trains would rumble by there, lots of trains. And coal smoke, of course we had no air conditioning, hot, windows were open, coal smoke would waft into the rooms, and when the train would go by, you couldn't hear the lecture at all. Now the OBGYN residency program, when I came on, it was a 3-year program. 1 year on obstetrics, 1 year on surgery, then a year as resident on OB and GYN. And as Dr. Robley said, the GYN program was part of surgery at that time. Now, in when we moved into maternity, we had call letters, lighted call letters up on the side of the wall, and we had certain letters for certain individuals. We'd see those letters, then we'd answer the telephone. Now, in Barnes, we had a loudspeaker during the day. In the night, we had an old fellow named Jack would come and awaken us. He'd shine a flashlight in our eyes and shake us, and sometimes some of the fellows were pretty deep sleepers, and he'd have to come back 2 or 3 times, and he had some choice words for those fellows. So that was not bad.
John, I don't mean to go back. I wonder if we can't establish a little more clearly for the Department of OBGYN where the research laboratories were prior to the construction of the maternity hospital. And I don't recall, but I think they were in the clinic building.
That's right.
Yes, third floor.
On the third floor of the clinic building.
That's right.
And pathology also had their headquarters on that same floor.
That's right.
And the, I think the Department of OB, I think the research laboratories and offices there, actually looked southward out of the window, and they could overlook the construction of the maternity hospital.
That's right.
I think they were located in that area. You mentioned Jack, who ran the, in the rotunda of Barnes. There was a round area where the entire complete telephone system was harbored, and all the connections went through there. And Jack answered this telephone at night, and he'd get relief and run up and try to awaken a resident who was on call. I don't think we ought to pass by without mentioning some of the nurses. And if you recall, Dorcas Drake was the night supervisor at Barnes. Here was a hospital in which one woman was the total, complete supervisor of the entire establishment, with the exception of children's. And then, after maternity hospital was built, Lucille Spaulding was the night supervisor there. And Lucille Spaulding later went with Unit 21 in World War One over to Europe. Yeah. Then if you remember, before the even after maternity hospital was built, the gynecology was left in Barnes and left in the Department of Surgery under H.S. Crossman. And we had patients housed with female surgical patients on 2219. And there was a very pretty brown-eyed nurse who was the head nurse up there, and the best I can recollect, her name was Helen Moffat. Does that ring any
yes.
memory?
Yeah, that's correct.
And I think then, at a later time, when Rand Johnson Hospital was constructed, and this gets to a time period of about 1934, I guess, the GYN ward then became 5200, a part of 5200. Mm-hmm. And I think Miss Moffat was also the head nurse up there. Now, it was left in that fashion, of course, with the gynecology there, but it fell strictly under obstetrics and gynecology when the department was turned from surgery back to OBGYN when Dr. Otto Schwartz completed his sabbatical leave and came back, during which period Dr. Tausig, Fred Tausig, administered the department as the chief head of the department. Because I know he was the one who gave me my apartment as an intern at the time. That would have been in, I started in 1928 with the internship, so he was there at that time. And then Dr. Otto Schwartz took over the full management of the department and gynecology, but left Crossan on as pretty much responsible for gynecology, along with Quentin Newell, Q.U. Newell, and Charles O'Keefe. Well,
could I ask a question? Dr. Hobbs has mentioned McJunkett, who said 15 of you will fail, or words to that effect, and you were telling me the
yes.
same story.
Oh, well,
this is extremely different from today's attitude of the faculty toward the students.
Very much so.
Could we discuss that point, how it has changed over the years?
Well, briefly, our orientation was a very brief one. Dr. Allison, the orthopedic surgeon, you see, I'd like to say we all the way through here instead of just plain I, but let me put it this way. We had a class in our freshman year that entered. There were 71 of us. The dean was Dr. Allison, orthopedic surgeon, right fresh back from World War I. Dr. Allison stepped up on the platform, and his first year of medical school class was assembled, 71 of us. He didn't call us gentlemen, he just said, you all out there, he said, are 71. That's too large a class. We don't intend to graduate that many. 10 of the men sitting here will not get into their sophomore year. We will build up the sophomore class by taking on 10 additional. 10 from the sophomore class will not make junior and senior year because we have an influx from Columbia University, which is only
Columbia,
University at Columbia in Missouri, because they are only a two-year medical school and we take their junior and senior years. Now, John, we didn't turn pale. Most of us had a little more exposure to the 1918 flu epidemic than you had, although you are mentioned it in an article. We were out on the hill, or at least I was, and some of our classmates were, and we were in wooden barracks, and we filled up Barnes Hospital with flu cases. I didn't get the flu. I don't know why. I guess I was too mean. But at any rate, our student army training corps was called SATC, Stick Around Till Christmas. That's why I had 3 years out on the hill and then got my BS degree in 23. Now, the percentage of men in our freshman class the first year had degrees, either BS or MD degrees, 25%. In our fourth year class, 50% of the men getting their MD degrees in 1925 had either BS, MDs, and some of them had MS degrees.
Was this unusual in medical schools in the United States at this time?
I think it was probably about average. 9 of us in our class graduating 25 got our BS degrees in 1923 from, and that BS degree was given through Washington University only to those who had their pre-med 2 or 3 years or 4, whatever it was, out on the hill before coming to medical school.
No.
That made us awfully aggressive. it made us suddenly realize in our freshman year that no longer we were individuals in an alma mater, a nursing mother institution, but our survival depended on us alone in a hostile environment. And I think that explains what was later said about my class.
Which was?
Our class, which was the worst class that Washington University ever graduated. Not from a standpoint of degrees, but that we were arrogant, we took no advice from anyone, and we insulted the entire faculty.
That sounds like today.
Oh, today the faculty doesn't dare say that.
one of the things that
interests me tremendously is how very different the attitude of the faculty today is. Now, you gentlemen have all been here in this period, and you must have seen the change.
Oh, yes, very much so.
Now they almost never flunk out any student. They try very hard to keep him in. They've got 138 students as opposed to 71, and they take very few transfers. The whole idea is to let the student decide what he wishes to learn rather than the faculty setting the rules. How did this change occur? I'm sure it didn't come overnight, but it must have come over the years. And can any of you give me some help on that?
I'd like to speak to that a little bit, Dr. Boardman. The students at that time, and our periods in school overlap to some degree, but the students worked very hard. This created a tremendous cohesiveness between students, and I dare say that both of you will agree. You came here, you had friends, but your own classmates, the people you went to school with, became some of your most intimate friends and associates.
Very definitely.
And this was a collective effort to get through. I think there was also a spirit of reasonable helpfulness. However, each one worked as an individual, and if you weren't keeping up and you got the pink slip from the administrator's office, you didn't have too much help from your colleagues. They were too busy. On the other hand, the attitude of the faculty was a very warm, generous feeling, in my opinion. There was started, about the time I came into school, the concept of a faculty advisor. This didn't survive. It didn't live. I had heard some sophomore students ahead of me talk about physiology, and I just blatantly put down my request for Dr. Erlanger as my faculty counselor. And my classmates chided me very much, said that's the worst thing you could do. Well, it turned out not to be. As an example, we got in physiology with chronexy, and chronexy was a miserable thing of measuring a little time on the nerve of conduction. And I was on my knees under the floor, trying to connect some wires together, actually hoping I could rearrange the wires to make the test come out all right.
And I know what you mean, Artie.
I was conscious of a pair of black shoes standing by me, and I said, damn Cornexy and damn Joe Erlanger. And about that time, said, you having trouble, Mr. Arneson? And there was Dr. Erlanger. Right? Well, he was a very warm advisor. And I remember at Thanksgiving, he lived over here on the first one, I think.
It was Waterman,
yes, right. And he had he only had three representatives. He had Jerry Levy out of your class, and he had Dick Taylor out of your class. And was Jerry Levy in your class too?
No,
year before out of your class, I guess. No, before that. But he had Jerry Levy as a junior. He had Dick Taylor as a sophomore, and he had me as a freshman. He had us there at his house for dinner, and it was very pleasant. And this was good. Now, he wasn't a man you could go to on the spur of the minute, but I think I would cite this as an example of the attempt on the faculty to be very warm. But on the other hand, they were disciplinarians. This was sort of a Geheimrat atmosphere. And I don't know of any school, of any graduate I've run across, that had more moral incentive instilled into them than we did in this school at that time. I think much different now than it was then. But I think the moral concept of responsibility was the big thing that the faculty at that time delivered to the students?
One of the things which the Committee on Medical Education, which I'm a member, struggles with these days is the fact that when the students feel pressure put upon them, instead of this reasonable helpfulness and student cohesiveness that you mentioned for your class, the students get to be antagonists to each other. So that if a student leaves his notebook on the table, the other students will tear it up and throw it away. If an assignment is given to a class, the first student will come in and take the book and hide it so that the other students will not be able to get it. Why did your classes react so favorably to pressure, and the modern classes react so unfavorably?
First, I want to say to Dr. Arneson, after almost 50 years in medicine, I've just learned about Cronach's. I never did understand Cronach's. I can tell you, it was lots of fear. Everybody was fearful of being a failure. Lots of fear in our class. And we didn't dare talk back to professors, which they do today. I've seen students, when we were students, our professor would often come into the room to talk to us, we'd stand up. Today, the professor talks to them, they don't even listen, they don't give him attention. And I've seen them take chairs. I saw this happen one time in our conference room. Dr. Willard Allen was speaking, and a senior student came in, took his chair from behind him, sat down. Dr. Allen was ready to sit down. He had no chair. And we had respect. We were taught respect, and we felt that we should be respectful. And that is gone today with too many of the students. Now, some, I'm sure, have it.
Well, there's another factor, too. You see, in that period of time, there were giants. There isn't a chance for an individual to be a giant today as there was then. Graham was a tremendous figure. And he had, during the war with the flu epidemic, he was the one who had delayed this incision into the chest to drain pus into a laudable pus. Ernest Sachs, who was the neurosurgeon here, was a very forceful individual, very demanding individual. And one time when I was on surgery, I had a cold, and you didn't dare go in his operating room if you had a cold. And I got Paul Rollins to take my place. And then later on, Paul was on the same service, and we exchanged because he had a cold. And I was scrubbed up there, and I knew pretty soon that Dr. Sachs was going to want the so-called bayonet forceps. And I spoke to the scrub nurse, who is now Mrs. Bricker, and asked if she wouldn't get the bayonet forceps out. But they didn't get them out, and the intern had to pick all the instruments out, and Paul Rollins had picked them out. He hadn't put in the bayonet forceps. And Dr. Sachs asked for them, and I said, "Dr. Sachs, they will be ready in just a moment." He said, "Just a moment." He said, "Dr. Arneson," said, "haven't you been on this service for 6 long weeks?" I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "Well, if you don't know now, you'll never know." He said, "Get out." They were domineering, and they were giants at the time, and this made a lot of difference.
Why do you think that we cannot have giants now? Has medicine changed to the extent where it's a group?
It's too complicated.
I'd like to maybe correct an impression that I made. I referred to it about Dr. Elmer's class in physical diagnosis. We worked in small groups. We were not competitive in the sense of being childish and interfering with others. The four men that we worked together in our first 2 years, and in the junior and senior year, we were split up, but we always worked in groups. I don't think any of us ever did anything alone, either in either period of the clinic or the pre-clinic work. For example, Ben Fox, that was associated with a great deal, and he was intern on obstetrics. He later went to the Mayo Clinic, general surgery, and together we both were on elective Graham's course in our senior year. But Ben was a late sleeper in the morning, And every time that Elmer called on Ben Fox, Fox was asleep in class. And one time he suddenly woke, and I was sitting next to him, and I dug him in the ribs, and I said, he's talking about mitral stenosis. I said, you better give it a bad prognosis. Ben came to with a jump and says, well, they'll kind of linger on for a while, and then they drop off. And Elmer blew his top. He said, this is the worst sensory blankety-blank class I've ever taught. He set a bunch of idiots in here. He says, I'm going to flunk a bunch of you. But Ben was wide awake then. The exam was coming up in the next 2 days. I had fair notes, and what we did in Forest Park, Arnie spoke about baseball diamonds over there. We didn't have a baseball diamond there. We went over and literally hung from trees, not with a rope around our necks, but I think that's what we were thinking about. But we'd swing from trees, Tarzan style, sort of, and study over there, groups four, fives, and six. Of course, the fraternities were pretty well glued together. And Ben studied all of my notes, plus the textbook. Studied with him the second day. He got 98 on the examination, I got 94. I never have forgiven him. But that was all the way through. Our work in elective works were always in groups. We were highly competitive with each other, but it was on the basis of trying out. And we simply told the faculty that we didn't like them. We just told them we didn't like them. And we were in competition with the faculty largely, I think, because we had so very many young men teaching us. And some of us had just enough of the Army experience or memory of what the older ones said about it, to which we were anxious to take anything in the 1920s from anybody.
Could I be forgiven for another story of faculty-student relationship? The old amphitheater was up on the third floor of Barnes Hospital, and we had our general class meetings up there during the clinical period, and Dr. Sachs held a conference once a week. And he would call students from his row down to examine a patient. And this particular day, there was a man with a huge swollen ankle. It was a chondroma. I didn't know it at the time. And he had me examine the patient. And he kept asking me what I could feel and the texture of the thin shell on this. And we finally got around to something about ping pong balls. This passed by, and there appeared in the newspaper a little article about the manufacturing of ping pong balls, and I cut this out. And I went into the laboratory over here at the medical school one day, and Dr. Sachs walked in. And I didn't function after that. I mean, I just got ready to leave.
Arnie, I know what you mean.
Fear.
So Dr. Sachs finished what he came in for and went over, and he was rinsing off his hands, and I was trying to edge my way out, and he reached into his vest pocket and he pulled out the same clipping about the ping pong ball that he had saved, that he cut out of the paper at the same time.
So, underneath that gruff exterior beat a heart of gold.
Yes, certainly did. Can I tell one more little story about a faculty member? Dr. Schwartz, Henry Schwartz, we passed by, I think, and we shouldn't have passed him by so rapidly. During the year that I was in the path lab, which was in between, just before I went back in as a resident, I took him home each day for lunch. Now, he said the students didn't have automobiles, but we've got to come back to the outpatient service, and I did acquire one on the outpatient service, and I want you to tell about that in a moment. In driving him home, I recounted what had just been in the newspaper announcement. Professor Boise of St. Louis University had isolated thaline. And I said, Dr. Schwartz, that was a pretty important thing. Well, he said, I'll tell you something. He said, that fellow Doisy isn't so smart the way he would talk. And he said, you know my office there is in my home. Yes. And he said, you know, I've got that carriage tray that comes in. I said, yes, sir. And he said, those women come in, have their babies, and they bring me those little bottles of urine. I said, yes, sir. He said, well, he said, I suppose they think sometimes I look at it, maybe others think I throw it away. But for my nicest, cleanest patients, I take those bottles of urine, put them in the back of the refrigerator. And then when I have enough of that collected together, I go across the street to Mazarang's drugstore, and I get some of their very best raspberry syrup. And then I mix those bottles of urine and the raspberry syrup, and I put it up in little 4-ounce bottles with a cork in it. And when those old women come in with hot flavors, I give them that and tell them to take a teaspoonful every day. Now, Heber's medicine, the art of medicine, he didn't know what these things were. He knew the Abderhalden reaction, that was what you were worried about. But he knew that something in that urine relieved hot flashes.
I think something more we should say about Dr. Henry Schwartz. Of course, he was a beloved man. He organized the Department of Obstetrics here, and he maintained it with his own money for many years. And he had on Sunday mornings, he'd have some of his patients, rich patients, come in to a little office he had up on 3418. And he'd have an intern come up there and be with him at that time. And
I'm
sure
Sunday school.
Sunday school, we call Sunday school. I'm sure that you all remember. He used to call, he'd be over here at night, you know, he'd sit and smoke his cigar. And he would call his wife, and he'd say, "Hello, Laura, this is Henry." He'd been calling her for 50 or 60 years, and you'd never mistake his voice, but he always said, "Hello, Laura, this is Henry." Well, this one morning for Sunday school, I was the intern. And I got up there, and Mrs. Schwartz was there. She's sitting in the chair alongside the table. And when I went in the room, well, she popped up like a jack-in-the-box, and he said, "Dr. Hobbs, meet Mrs. Schwartz." He says, "Mama, sit down and keep sitting."
One of you mentioned before that this was the time of the changeover to full-time practice here. Now, there was a great deal of controversy, was there not? Could we discuss that for a minute or so?
John, you were here all the time during that time. Were you considered part-time then, or all the other full-time, or mixed?
Part-time. I was always part-time.
Did university pay you anything?
No. I was always part-time.
You never got a check from Morris University? Well, by golly, I did. I thought John got checks all the time. I had a commission in the Navy, which was inactive, thank goodness, and I was assigned teaching at City Hospital when junior and seniors. The whole medical school were on a complete rotation basis to turn out the MDs fast for World War II. And I was paid $1,200 a year for the 4 years teaching, which I enjoyed. It was one of my, I think it was probably the most enjoyable part of my whole medical career, because I had private patients and then taught City Hospital besides. During that time, Graham, who I still think was a great power in Washington University and outstanding, and perhaps was one of the last giants in pioneering work that he did. When Graham first came, I'm just dropping back a little bit, the most proud things that he would tell us as a class that he had been court-martialed in the Army. Court-martialed because he refused to stick needles and drain off the pus before it became thick enough. And when he first came on surgery, and in our elective work on surgery in our senior year, it was rib resection. And if the rib wasn't resected, the organized area with thick pus and connective tissue, why, the axe fell. But those patients got well, of course. Now, Graham, though, envisioned what we're seeing, I believe, taking place in all of our departments now, and necessarily a full-time department. That's when those of us that were like John and myself and others, not in the armed services, when we saw the 21 unit revived and sent out in World War II, we suddenly got the pressure from Schaefer and from
World War II.
Now, Schaefer was dean. And Schaefer did not have an MD degree. And a good many of us who were on the so-called essential teaching list would invite Graham to come over and have noon lunch with us. He did until the time was made so unpleasant for him that he didn't come anymore.
Why was it unpleasant?
Because he and Graham, among some others, wanted very much to have a full-time department and were writing the men in the 2nd Unit 21 telling them that they would be taken on as full-time men. The rest of us resented it, and we had Willard Allen back us up in that resentment. He did not want a full-time department in OB and GYN at all. He wanted it to be a mixed department and have the part-time faculty teaching. Arnie, is that fitting pretty much with what you have to say? You weren't around here then. You were a colonel in the Army. Now,
well,
did you get a letter along this line that we're talking about?
Well, Yeah. You see, the full-time urge came really in two ways. The first one from the Flexner Report. And this brought in then the strong heads of departments, preclinical as well as clinical.
That's 1910.
No, it was 14, 17, when Barnes Hospital was
really got
first
started in 1917 when they came in. That's when George Dock got
in. Yes.
And then each of these departments had a small, hard core of full-time people to maintain the department. Now, the concept of a Mayo Clinic type of organization was indeed conceived during World War II.
That's right.
And anyone who was in the armed forces was indeed contacted, and they were offered, and sometimes persuaded,
mm-hmm.
And the persuasion was sometimes pretty strong,
yeah.
to take these positions. And that specifically brought in Gene Bricker,
yes.
back in. It brought in Henry Schwartz,
yes.
back in. And
no.
others that I can't...
Oh, there were quite a few others. But I think also we contacted everybody that we could think of, and the reports, at least in OB and GYN, maybe as Willard Allen, the way they interpreted it was, that they wanted to come back as part-time and have private practice and still have their faculty appointments right on through to being full clinical professors. And that's the way it turned out. But Schaefer was the big stumbling block. We, a group of us, not again individual, we, plural, we, told Phil Schaefer to his face that he didn't know any medicine, he never had any medicine, that he was envisioning the kind of a medical school in the future that was written up in the Reader's Digest. Now that sounds pretty tough, and that's why they said that some of our class people talked back to faculty. We did.
Well, indeed, the situation became acrimonious at the time, and there were meetings between the then Barnes Hospital Society, the trustees of the university, and so on. The opponents of a solid, carte blanche, full-time list right down the line had a great deal of support from Dr. White, Lester White.
Yes, he did.
And of course, he had been away in the Army, too. But he was in the physiology. And he gave a great deal of support against a total full-time swing. But the situation became quite acrimonious there for Bob.
Well, D.K. Rose and...
Sam Grant.
Sam Grant and... the orthopedic surgeon,
Albert Key.
They were key men,
yeah. mm-hmm.
in arguing against the full-time scheme. And finally, it was fact accompli. Dr. Schaefer called me into his office, and he said, "I don't care what you people do." He says, "We're going to have a full-time clinic." Well, I said, "I'm surprised at that." And then Dr. Bradley convinced Mr. Rand that it was the thing to do. And Dr. Graham thought it was the thing to do. Dr. Erlanger thought it was the thing to do. And so... it was stated that Dr. Schaefer was going to resign, Dr. Graham would resign if it didn't go through. So the staff decided to go out on the hill and talk to the trustees of Washington University. And I was one of eight people that went out there, and we convinced the trustees it was the wrong thing to do.
What were the arguments on each side?
Well, that very evening, the whole thing was quashed. Dr. Graham didn't resign. Dr. Schaefer didn't resign. So that was the end of it. One thing it shows you, the power of the trustees of Washington University, they squashed it.
Mr. Wallace was the chancellor at the time. And in answer to your question, Dr. Boardman, it was set up with the concept of improving teaching. And the argument against it was that it really had no bearing or relationship to improving teaching. And Mr. Wallace...
At the medical school wanted control.
Yeah. And at the meeting you referred to, Mr. Wallace said very flatly, "If this plan will not improve teaching, we don't want to have the plan as..."
That's
as
correct.
That
nice
argument
summary.
Continued right through till the building of Queenie Tower, where the geographical full-time was solved.
Well, that's when Mr. Queenie said that he wouldn't take a censored penny from anything. He was going to put the entire thing up himself with all of his own money. Mm-hmm. And there would be a combination of part-time as well as full-time. And that was done also by getting some outside help to come and review the whole situation at Washington University. Yeah. Hildreth and you, John, were in on a good deal of that.
And Joe Hensley was brought back.
Yes.
And Knowles was also
yes.
brought back.
My goodness, you're getting really a lot of stuff, aren't you?
Well, this is delightful. I'm so glad we wouldn't have gotten it otherwise, because you people don't write it down.
May I tell a good joke on Dr. Sachs?
Please.
The only time I ever saw Dr. Sachs put in his place. Dr. Arneson is an ideal spokesman for me, only I had Sachs operating room and et cetera before that. Ernie Sachs was doing general surgery with Murphy. Matter of fact, Murphy and Sachs did the first appendectomy in Barnes Hospital when it was first opened. Sachs gave us lectures in diagnostic and general surgery. Graham couldn't stand Sachs. Maybe you want to strike that off the record, but Graham and Sachs were entirely at each other's throats. Sachs and A.O. Fisher didn't get along. Fisher gave Sachs a black eye one time when Fisher was told how to do a certain operation. Dr. Fisher said, "I'll see you later, Dr. Sachs," and that's what Fisher did, A.O. Fisher. These are the men that taught us in just a few years before. Well, Sachs had our class in the operating room amphitheater. That's where you all met. The idea of sepsis was sort of not too good, although all Sachs people had their hands washed in antiseptic solutions and so forth. Well, Sachs this day had a woman, and her abdomen was enormous. Of course, we all thought the woman was pregnant. She was black, and she was on the stretcher. And Sachs looked the class over to pick out the meekest and the mildest. And the meekest and the mildest in our class came down, and Sachs, who had a considerable front, butted, literally, that was called a bullpen. Sachs was a bull. He would butt a poor student around that would not stand up to him. Perhaps we called some butts down. Why, we didn't have the stomach, but we couldn't back up and just take the butts, or if he backed away, we'd take a step forward. The conversation went like this: "What do you see, doctor?" Well, for some reason or other, the poor student was completely overwhelmed by the situation, and he was getting nowhere. And finally, the black simply sat up on the stretcher, swung her feet over the side, and said, For God's sakes, doctor, if you see something that the young doctor don't see, please tell him. I want to get out of here." Sachs just held up both hands and walked out. It was the first time I ever had seen anybody get the best of it, and we all left and laughed. Did you ever ask him?
No.
Arnie, you know about his kicking.
Well, that's what I thought you were going to tell.
Oh, please do.
No,
I left that for you.
No, go on. You can tell it. Yeah.
Well, yes, that's what happened. Well, you know later what happened to the man he kicked, don't you? Yes, Henry. Over at, not the professor.
No,
from Oklahoma. Henry, that is in charge of all the animal and experimentation work.
For the neuro department?
For the whole neuro department. Sachs, something went bad. I guess he didn't have his vein in force. Sachs left the operating room, and Henry, a new orderly, or at least they thought he was an orderly. Maybe he was at that time. I know Henry very well. I was just like chat with him and eat over there. Was bending over, and Sachs simply hauled off and booted him right in the rear, and Henry nearly went through the instrument case, but did fall on his face. Now, that was just the wrong man, because Henry came from a very influential, financially backed family in Oklahoma, and he wanted medicine and couldn't get into medical school. He really was a brilliant person, because he's still in the department over there with the animals, and invented anesthesia machines, and is really a big asset. He says, "You do that again, Doc Sachs, and I'll kill you." And scared Sachs. And Sachs says, "You're fired." And Henry says, "Okay." Immediately left the operating room and went to the head of the neuro department and got a job. About 2-3 months later, Sachs walked in and started knees shaking. He said, "Well, what are you doing around here? I fired you." And he said, "It didn't make any difference." He said, "Doctor, who would be the head of the department? Name slipped. Now I'm just going to say it. He just hired me."
Sounds like Sachs.
You mean Nancy Blair's husband?
Yes. Larry. Oh, there.
You know, another thing that Dr. Boardman, I think would be interested in having is the transfusion story. You want to do that, John?
Well, in those days we had three methods. One was called the old hunger machine, which was used on medicine, and the second was the multiple syringe cannula method, which was used on surgery. And we, on the obstetrical service, used citrate transfusion. We were the first to use citrate transfusion in the institution. Dr. T.K. Brown was in charge of laboratories at that time, he and Dr. Dickman. And we got lots of reactions in those days because there were a lot of pyrogens in the test tubes and in the rubber tubing, and they cleansed them with solutions and so forth and so on, but still we got quite a few reactions. And one time they were getting reactions constantly. So they tore everything down to try to find out what was doing it. At that time we had our own still. We made our own distilled water. So they tore that down thinking there might be some leakage there, and they found the dead mouse in the still. Well, anyway, so finally the citrate method superseded all of the other two methods, and so we have to say that Dr. Brown was the first to start the citrate method in our own department.
Yeah, the other thing to show you some of the progress has been made, there was an anesthetic anesthesia machine on a tripod with wheels, and it had a cylinder of carbon dioxide and a cylinder of nitrous oxide on it. And if an emergency came in at night, and we had a relatively limited emergency service for many, many years, the resident or intern, as the case might be, it might even be Jack from the telephone board sometimes, this would be wheeled in, and somebody would put the mask over the patient, turn on a little carbon dioxide to make him breathe more, a little nitrous oxide to put him to sleep, and this was done by anybody that came along.
Well, we, the interns, when I was on surgery, a year I was on surgery, because I'd given lots of anesthetics at maternity. All of the anesthetics in maternity were given by the house staff. And we used ether, drop ether, and we used chloroform. And then we got a nitrous oxide machine sometime later on. Well, I had quotes and question mark, a lot of experience in anesthesia when I went on surgery. So they called on me a lot for anesthetics over there. I was Dr. Kofer's favorite anesthetist. I don't know whether you know that or not. And because we gave, at that time, we started them off on the old tripod machine, and then we'd switch to drop ether. And until I can see that first old McKesson machine that they brought in. We had one anesthetist that time, one paid anesthetist in Barnes Hospital, Lucille Larson, you remember her?
About, ma'am, very briefly tell a good joke. We haven't mentioned Dr. Burlingham, superintendent of the hospital. I suppose every class and every house officer has had experience with Dr. Burlingham. That is in our age group. How about that, Arnie? Burlingham was sober among the friends. John said that nobody, the students didn't have an automobile. I had an old Model T Ford just that my dad got for me. Got rid of it when I was on the house delivery service, and that's another story, but nevertheless. The OB department did use the old Model T Ford, which was not the old, but brand new then, in the outpatient service. And all the private patients had special nurses over on Pavilion and a lot of food. And we could not get in the cafeteria at night. And we were hungry. The temptation was to go and get a little cream, a little something or other, from the private pavilion. Well, those of us that were on private pavilion considered that those patients were our patients. Not that we would, under any circumstances, ever take any of their food, but we resented anybody else of the on the OB staff would come over to private pavilion, and we policed it. So that sort of put the pressure when food was missing on the right person. So I remember going to Otto Swartz and said, couldn't we use the outpatient machine to go to Garavelli's? Now, this is about Burlingham. He said, yes, you may, if you just go there and come right back with the food. I said, we'll pay for our own food, but I said, we can eat on quarters. Well, you're not supposed to. And I said, well, then you don't have to know we're going to. He said, okay. So one time we went over there in a very, very heavy rain, and there were wooden paving blocks. Anybody remember the wooden paving blocks around Garavellas? And Ben Fox was with me, and Fox and I got each other into trouble and out of trouble all through out on the hill in the medical school. And for no good reason, we stuck a lot of these paving blocks, maybe four or five or six, in the car, on the floor of the car, and came back heavily loaded with hamburgers and baked ham and all the rest of the food. When we got back, we all ate the food, and here were the paving blocks. We didn't know what to do with them. We didn't have any reason for bringing them, but there they were at the long end of the hall, the intern quarters on the third floor, were some of the paving blocks. Well, one of the assistants, one of the older men, our degree of what we did was a little more refined, meaner maybe, but one of these fellows picked up a paving block and zooped it down. It was a billiard ball, and it whammed against the door like that, just as the black orderly was going by on the outside of the door. The black orderly let out a yell and said, "Somebody's trying to kill me. They threw something at me." Well, the five of us that were house officers realized that we were in trouble with Birmingham, real trouble. We went together in a huddle, just like a football game. Jointly, we said this. The glass fell on the inside of the door, not the outside. So we didn't throw anything outside the door. True? Yes. Now, this is not my... I'm the person saying yes, not the one that put the question. Well, furthermore, why not take the automatic door opener off the door so the door would be loose and free to bang in the wind? Good idea. Then let's all get the hell out of here as quickly as possible and get to breakfast and wait until we're called in individually. And what are we all going to say the same thing individually? Well, that was what the real huddle was about. When we finished breakfast, we came back up, noticed glass on the floor, door stopper off the door, door free to swing. And that's it. Oh, every one of us, all five, were called down into Birmingham's private office and grilled and grilled and grilled. I think I was the fifth one to go in. He said, "Dr. Robling," he said, "I can't understand this." Well, what's there? He said, "You said that to the best of your knowledge and belief, there was nothing thrown through the door." Well, I said, when we got back from breakfast, just repeated the same thing. We found glass on the inside. If anything was thrown through from the inside outside, I should think the glass would be outside, not inside. "Oh," he said. He looked at me. Well, he said, "I guess that's all." I said, "Thank you, sir."
You ought to write a detective story about that.
That's true.
I think, Dr. Berman, also, you ought to know something about the obstetrical outpatient service.
Yes.
The patients were seen in the clinic. They were booked, and they would call in when they went into labor, and they were delivered at home. And there was a big, heavy box of instruments and towels and things and drapes that we took with us. And then the resident would round up two students. We worked in pairs, And we'd go out into all sections of the city. You know, that was done fearlessly. There was no problem.
By streetcar.
On a streetcar, yeah. And it was an all-night job, and you stayed there until the child was born. There was never any fear or any question.
No,
never molested at all.
We scrubbed our hands in sinks in cold weather. We'd go out the yard and scrub our hands, and sometimes we would be there for hours and hours. I remember the first case I went on, we went out one afternoon, we were there all night, we came back the next afternoon. And it was a Negro's house, and they fixed us some food. Bed bugs were running around everywhere, and a little bit different than the boys have it today.
This is the old traditional way. My father used to tell a story just like it, and he was in the class of 01. And my brother, who was in the class of 32, was doing exactly the same thing.
We had to have 14 cases. That's what you all had
That's
to
right,
do, too.
Right,
we had to personally deliver. Of course, the two of us worked in pairs. We
delivered them on the ironing board. We put the old ironing board under the bed if they had an ironing board.
Dr. Robley mentioned going to Garavellas to get food and coming back. And there were certainly some very strict rules about eating. I mean, I'm shaken today when I see all the food being carried around the cars of the hospital. People walking on drinking soft drinks out of a tin can, but it's an entirely different atmosphere than it was then.
I guess our whole society
it's all very different.
One brief thing I'd like to ask about, I think John said that their senior class, that came along right after mine, did not have the third trimester entirely elected. Is that correct, John? Well, we did, and we had to elect a minimum of 300 hours, and we couldn't take more than 450 hours, and that had to be divided between two departments, and you couldn't work in the department unless the department head gave you permission. The man that I worked with Graham in his department, to our surprise, was tuberculosis of the mammary gland in dogs, and we got active tubercle bacilli from the head of the department in bacteriology, because we knew the first thing Graham was going to ask was, where'd you get the TB bugs? And we told him from then on, our article was published under our own names a few months before we got our degrees. That's from the Department of Surgery, which overwhelmed both of us. We had no idea of anything of that. The 150-hour deal was with Otto Swartz, and that was our brainstorm again, Fox and Romley. We said we felt sure that we could work out the induction of labor, the cause of the onset of labor, if we had guinea pigs. And we would take the placenta of the guinea pig at time of delivery, grind it up and inject it, and have a group of pigs one way or the other. And we thought that we could produce an anaphylactic reaction by injecting ground up guinea pigs. But it was an awful messy sort of a thing, and I think Otto was quite intrigued by the idea. He went along with it. When we reported to Otto, he said, what did you learn about guinea pigs? Dr. Fox said, we will learn how guinea pigs copulate. Well, Otto Swartz blew his top, but he'd given both of us a house officer's job. He said, what else did you learn? Well, I said, we also learned, because we tagged the male's ears at the time of copulation, but it didn't seem to interfere with his sex function.
I can see it.
Well, Dr. Bergman, you stop us when you want to, but another little item I'd like to mention on the record is the old Knight Clinic. The Knight Clinic was for the treatment of syphilis, which was a very prevalent disease. You know, you just don't see it anymore. And the patients were brought in for injections of mercury, I think it was, beginning the hip injection.
Arsenamide.
Bismuth. Yeah, and this also offered an opportunity for young people starting out to have employment in there. The students were obliged to go and give these injections through a rotation. And Dudley Smith, who was a member of the OBGYN department, had a position, a salaried position there for a long while. And they would drive up in cars, you know, sometimes pretty good-looking cars that would go in for their shots, and that way they would go. But I want to mention one more thing, then we'll send it to Dr. Hobbs. And this was the emphasis that was given research. Now, that hasn't changed. The emphasis is still given research. But I remember I came here as a freshman student, and Professor Ranson from Northwestern was here for a very brief time in neuroanatomy. A fellow classmate, his name was Morris. How it happened, no one knows, but hadn't been here very long before Ranson invited Morris and invited me to take some extra time and come up to count nerve fibers. Well, this was a menial little task of looking through a microscope and counting nerve fibers, which we did. He appreciated it so much that he didn't have us take the final examination. Probably would have flunked out if it hadn't been for that. Then, in my senior year, there was a great deal of work that was done in surgery and research over there. And Bob Ellman with Dr. Graham had gotten the idea of trying to develop a test for pancreatic disease by measuring blood amylase. And this was done by dropping a little serum into a starch solution and had a little tube where it would drip through, and you measured the viscosity or the change in viscosity. And I fell heir to a job going over there and running these tubes through for Bob Ellman. But I offer this again maybe it's because it was a smaller place. For the cross-fertilization and feeding between faculty and student and the stimulus that this gave individuals at that time. Now, Dr. Hobbs, tell us about our old friend Twilight Sleep and her duties as a resident.
Could I interject this? Mm-hmm. We've spoken of most of the heads of the departments, mm-hmm. with the exception of one that I know, and that was Dr. Sluder. Dr. Sluder was a famous ENT man in those days, and he invented the Sluter tonsillotome. We used to take out tonsils in the clinic. I've taken out many tonsils in the clinic with the Sluter tonsillotome. Well, anyway, he was a tremendous man. He must have been about 6'5", broad shoulders. He wore a speckled vest. And he lectured to us once a week, and he had a routine. He'd come in, and he'd take off his coat, slowly hang it up on a tree. And he had a gown, his gown hanging there, and he'd put this gown on, and I sat on the corner. He'd back up to me to tie his gown in the back. I felt like a pygmy beside this tremendous man. Then he'd walk around, he'd go up to his lecture desk, and then he'd walk back to the door. He said, "Harry, oh Harry, where the hell are you, Harry?" Harry was the deaner. Here'd come Harry with two baskets on his arms, full of skulls and dissections, beautiful dissections. He'd brought from Germany. Then he lectured through a
megaphone.
And a little tiny megaphone. He had a big handlebar mustache. So he'd pick up this little megaphone with a flourish. He'd pick it up, put it up under his whiskers, and he'd say, "Can you hear me back there? Damn it, can you hear me?" And we'd all say, "Yes." And then he'd start off with his lecture. Okay, now about twilight sleep. Twilight sleep, of course, was started in Germany, which consisted of giving the laboring woman morphine and scopolamine. And Dr. Henry Schwartz introduced twilight sleep into this country, in this department. And sometimes we had some men who would twilight the patient, and they'd promise them they were going to have a painless labor. They'd give them twilight sleep, and they'd rupture the membranes. The woman may or may not start in labor. And sometimes they'd be in labor or in the delivery room for 24 hours and more.
Or more.
And, of course, the woman was completely snowed. They gave them a lot of morphine, a lot of Demerol. Of course, today we'd never do that. Scopolamine and morphine. We'd never do that. Now, every patient had to have an attendant there at all times. Nobody ever left the room. The house officer or nurse or both had to be there at all times. And you had your hand on the abdomen, feeling the contractions. The nurse would have her hand there, student nurse. And I've heard that there was a little hand-holding sometimes under the sheet when they were timing the contractions. I don't know about that.
Why, John, I never heard of
it. Anyway, twilight sleep now is passe and all to the good.
Monitors now. Yes, mechanical monitors.
Sometimes you sat there for 24 hours.
Oh,
right.
Yes.
Been so very kind to give us all this time. Let me ask you end all of this, whether you could tell me what you think is the greatest change or changes which have occurred in obstetrics since you started in this field, obstetrics and gynecology.
Dr. Boardman, that's an excellent question. The change has been terribly dramatic. The department, you know, came to life with the American Board of Obstetrics and Gynecology in 1930 with examinations in Philadelphia and board certified. The question of board certification in OB and GYN has stood up very nicely for, from 76. At the present time, the national organizations, and Dr. Arneson knows more about that than I do because he's a member of two of them, are fragmenting a bit with the oncology and splitting up again, just a little bit. I hope it never happens, but just a little bit of split between OB and GYN. Now, Arnie, I know you specialized in GYN, were the original oncologist around here in tumor work, and it is quite conceivable that gynecology, I hope, will never become another department of surgery. But it certainly could, the tumor part, become a department of oncology in the future, and probably will. The unification of OB and GYN really is based upon having a patient who first is a female, and second, the part of her anatomy is the genital organs. Around here, we don't do breast surgery. In the East, they do radicals and other kinds of mammography. I think the change an OB-GYN is away from surgery. And having been a surgeon and until I retired, I regret it, but I'm also quite confident that the big development, along with oncology, has been the understanding of all the steroids, not only the female hormones, but the entire steroids. Now, a personal experience, if you pardon me, when Tom Burford had his day 2 years ago in June with a professor in research on the causes of cancer, I like to attend those, and I figured that'd be the last time I'd ever stand up in that big wall amphitheater. And I always do stand up in the back because I like to move around and get the feel of those around me. And a very attractive young woman, I don't think she was a graduate student, I imagine she was a junior or senior, came and stood next to me just because I was in a position where he could see. I noticed her notebook, and she was putting down things, and I could read everything in her notebook. I couldn't understand one single word the woman wrote down. She was following the lecture. I could get about every tenth word the lecture made. And it confirmed my impression that I should retire. Now, does that summarize things?
The second
thing in closing is the computer. And those who program computers, not just for medicine, unfortunately, but I wish they would feel that way more about it in medicine, but the industrialists that are programming computers say garbage in and garbage out, and unfortunately we are not in medicine saying garbage in. We expect garbage in and good stuff to come out, and it does not.
Very good. I approve of that feeling. That happens. We're
retrogressing some. We're going back to the old days. No anesthetic, many cases, mild anesthesia. And even a lot of them are going back to home deliveries now. And of course we have fathers in the delivery rooms now, which we didn't used to. They couldn't even come near the delivery suite in those days. And of course, tremendous strides have been made in the use of anesthetic agents. Much safer than our day when they gave so much morphine and
scopolamine. What would you say, Dr.
Well, I think the biggest change that has taken place in obstetrics and gynecology has been the move of obstetrics from an art into a science. At the time that we were in school and residents and early practitioners, you caught babies, you had some fears of eclampsia, you had magnesium sulfate that you injected into some to stop the convulsions, and the whole field of blood chemistry was still unplowed. Now today, if you look through a journal of obstetrics and gynecology, the articles that are there on obstetrics deal with all kinds of endocrinology, things which I don't understand. But this has elevated obstetrics into a science that is compatible on a level, at least, with medicine, surgery, and even ophthalmology has got quite a bit of science to it now too. And I think that has changed the picture more than anything else. Now the surgical phases of gynecology, they too have advanced. When we had our training, we did an un-Halstead type of operation. We did lots of supervaginal hysterectomies. We took great big bites of tissue with catgut. But the Halstead concept of surgery moved into gynecology, and today a resident finishing here with his program of obstetrics and gynecology is a far better surgeon than were we at the time we had our training. I don't think this will necessarily take gynecology out of obstetrics back to surgery. This won't happen unless obstetrics becomes such a self-sufficient phase of its own. If that ever occurs, then I think the two might be divided again.
Well, this has been very interesting.
May I just say one more thing?
Yes, please.
There was a Dr. Schumann in in Philadelphia, who was a great storyteller. He's been here, you know, he entertained people. And as he grew older, he went to fewer and fewer meetings, and some of his friends approached him and asked him why he didn't come to the meetings. He said, well, he said, you know, he said, I don't get around as well as I used to get around. And besides that, I don't hear as well as I used to hear. But most of all, what I do hear, I don't understand.
Well, I'm sure that will never happen to this group. There are students who are still interested in this field. I like to call your attention to Mr. Stephen Brody, who's a third-year student now, going into his fourth year, who just won the History of Medicine Prize at the American Association for History of Medicine on a biography of Sir Fielding Ould, the first man midwife in Ireland, and who is going over to the Rotunda in Dublin with the money he got to do further work in this field. And apparently Sir Fielding worked on the dynamics of delivery and the relationship of the sacrum to the way in which the child was turned when it came out. And I think that as long as we have young students who are interested in this field, it's going to be an extremely interesting and dynamic field, as it was in your time. So let me again thank you all for taking this time and for helping us with us, and we're delighted to have you here. And let me also invite you to stay a moment and see our rare book building and our archives, where your tape will be put.
Enjoyed this very, very much.
And very kind of all of you.
History is very important. We don't pay enough attention to history.
I'm prejudiced, but a lot of people don't feel that way about it.